My next guest is Shelly Antonovich, Senior Director of Industry and Financial Analysis at the Investment Company Institute, ICI, who they're the leading association representing regulated funds globally. And Shelly specifically, her role involves conducting in-depth research on the structure and trends of ETFs, mutual funds, closed-end funds, including how these vehicles impact and interact with markets, and also examining the regulatory side of the equation. And I should note, prior to joining ICI in 2005, Shelly spent 13 years at the Federal Reserve Board. She was a senior economist there. And I'm now very pleased to have Shelly joining me via phone from Washington, D.C. Shelly, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, Shelly, I'm going to put you on the spot right off the bat. You cover all regulated funds. Do you have a favorite structure? And no pressure here, even though this is an ETF podcast.
No, we don't. You know, I work for the Trade Association, ICI. We cover all the regulated fund products. And really, it's sort of like a family. You love your entire family. And you know, just to be serious about it, you know, each one of the products that we represent, or the different types of funds that are 40 Act regulated funds, they all have very good points that are helpful to investors achieve their main goals, which is diversification, being able to save for their long-term financial goals. And really, a lot of our members or fund groups that are our members, they offer all of the main different products. They really don't care which product, whether it's the ETF product or the mutual fund product or the closed-end fund product that an investor prefers. They offer them, and the investor can make the decision based on their own preferences.
Well, we are going to focus on ETFs this week, and I have several topics for us to get to. And I actually thought we'd start by going back to March of last year. So, of course, markets were under extraordinary pressure at the time. ETFs were front and center in that. And there was tremendous trading volume in ETFs, and a number of bond ETFs saw pretty sizable discounts. I know following that situation, you helped put together a comprehensive report on how ETFs handled everything. I'd love to hear some key takeaways. Like, what did you find in evaluating how ETFs handled that market crisis?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the you know, last March was really a huge financial crisis, both, you know, within the U.S. and globally. And that crisis is different if you roll back to the global financial crisis over a decade ago. I mean, the triggers were extremely different. The trigger in the global financial crisis was one where you had the financial markets spilling over onto the real economy. Whereas in this crisis, it is more a healthcare crisis that then impacted the real economy, and that had massive implications for financial markets. And we saw that. The one thing I think that we showed in our paper, and we actually have a whole series of papers on funds experiences during the COVID-19 crisis in March 2020, and the paper specifically on ETFs showed that ETFs were extremely resilient during the depths of that crisis. We have survey data that shows that despite the volatility surging up to levels that we hadn't seen since the crisis in 2008-09, that actually more authorized participants stepped in, and they facilitated a much higher level of both creations and redemptions in March 2020 than during a calmer, more normal period, which we picked to be March of 2019, when the market was rising and economic prospects were looking great. So we're hoping that this evidence that we've got on the how APs reacted during this crisis will allay concerns that regulators and policymakers have voiced in the past about APs stepping away from the ETF primary market during a crisis period. So that's the primary market. But a lot of the people that are going to be listening to you trade on the secondary market. And the one thing that we did get is we got some data from Cboe on their largest exchange, BZX, that showed that ETF liquidity providers, so these are both the registered market makers and the other liquidity providers, and these other liquidity providers don't have obligations. They can go in, come out, decide to post two-sided quotes whenever it is sort of, financially optimal for them to do that. And what we saw was that both registered market makers who do have the obligation and these other liquidity providers continued to provide two-sided quotes in ETF shares on the secondary market. And that really, as you said, this really helped facilitate all of that record volume that we saw in ETF trading. So the crux are, in summary, we feel the entire ETF ecosystem, it really held up and it provided a stable means for investors to access liquidity and transfer risk.
Shelley, I've spent a lot of time on this podcast, probably more than I should, trying to dispel ETF myths. And they're the ones we all hear, right? That somehow ETFs are going to exacerbate market declines, or ETFs will fail under market stress. They'll bring down the financial system. And every time there's been a big market event, ETFs pass with flying colors. We saw it with a financial crisis back in 2008. If you want to look at the fourth quarter of 2018, certainly last year's COVID crash, even if you want to bring in the recent GameStop situation where there were a few ETFs that kind of got caught up in that and performed just fine. At what point do you think we can finally say ETFs are battle tested? Because they have been around for 28 years now.
Well, I think, personally, I think we reached that point a while ago. I certainly felt like we reached that point in December 2015 with the crisis in the high yield bond market. And if you go back, and ICI, we did a blog on this, it's on our ICI viewpoints, and you go back and you look at the experience of high yield bond ETFs during that time, they performed admirably. They provided liquidity to the underlying market. They allowed investors to be able to do risk transfer in high-yield bond exposure. And they did not implode, which was really one of the doomsday scenarios that we had continually heard about. Just speculation by policymakers who were concerned that bond ETFs provided an illusion of liquidity, and that is absolutely not the case. They certainly performed very, very well. There were very little net redemptions to funds, and secondary market trading volume in high-yield bond ETFs during that time soared. And it wasn't just the large ones. I looked at all of them, from the large to the small, and they all had increases in volume that were almost twice their ADVs.
Well, and we saw an even bigger test of the bond ETF market last March, right? Just talking about what happened with the COVID crash. I mean, it's my belief that bond ETFs were acting as price discovery vehicles, and the discounts that we saw were more reflective of the true valuation of the underlying bonds. Yet again, another test where ETFs, they stood up to really extraordinary pressure in the markets. Shelley, now look, as much as I love ETFs, I don't want to just be a cheerleader. And so let me ask you, what are some real challenges facing ETFs, or at least areas where you think the ETF industry can improve on?
Well, I think one area that we've seen, and this isn't, I don't know that it's a challenge in terms of regulation. I think with the new ETF rule that has really leveled the playing field for all of the ETF sponsors, whereas before there were some that had advantages that others didn't have that got exemptive relief later, that has all been taken care of and it's all standardized now, which I think has been really a benefit. I think, you know, in terms of challenges, one is I think there is a challenge to growth here. While you might think that, oh, how can she be saying that? They're growing like crazy. Well, they are, but if you think about the size of the ETF industry, as of year-end 2020, about $5.5 trillion, you look at the size of the mutual fund industry, and this is the long-term mutual fund industry, it's over $20 trillion. So still a long way to go in terms of being a product that's equal to the size of the mutual fund industry. So how did the mutual fund industry get so large? Well, you know, they're set up to be able to pull in incremental dollars from smaller retail investors. And I think that's going to be somewhat of a challenge for ETFs, right? You know, I could go in and set up an account with a mutual fund, and I can have money, $100, taken out of my checking account every month and put into my mutual fund. It's set up for these smaller savers to be able to accumulate savings in an ETF, because retail investors are buying them on the secondary market. They've got to have this brokerage account. They have to be able to, you know, trade enough or buy enough in a size that it's going to be somewhat reasonable for them to do it. Also, the movement that we've seen into the ETF industry has been coming from, on the retail side, has been coming from financial advisors. And we have Cerulli Associates has data on this. And you can see fee-based advisors are definitely moving their clients' assets more towards ETFs and away from mutual funds. But those clients have a lot of investable assets. So it's not that smaller sort of retail group where, you know, when you want to take that next step, you want to be able to get into that group and appeal to that group.
Yeah, I think the key space that ETFs are going to have to penetrate to really continue the extraordinary growth is the 401k space, right? I mean, mutual funds, because of the structure and the way 401k plans are set up, that's kind of, we call it the Alamo, right? I mean, that's where mutual funds are making their last stand. And until ETFs can really make headway there, mutual funds are going to hang on to the assets. Go ahead.
It's not really clear, though, you know, what where the advantages of ETFs or sort of the characteristics of ETFs that people cite about why they want the ETF product, right? The ability to trade intraday, the fact that, you know, it can have tax efficiency depending upon how the ETF is structured. Those main points are sort of moot in a 401k. Most 401k investors rebalance once a year, so they are not doing a lot of trading. And also a lot of 401ks do not have brokerage windows. You still need a brokerage window on a 401k to get access to the ETFs. And how you do that, and I know right now there's been a lot in the news about dealing with fractional shares, right, and how you account for fractional shares. Mutual funds do that automatically. They've done that forever. That is how they can take the sort of biweekly, you know, fixed dollar amounts in, because they have an accounting system that's already set up for fractional shares, and it always has been. So ETFs trading on the secondary market, you know, and even with regular company shares that are trading on the secondary market, got to deal with that fractional share issue. And I know that there's been sort of developments in that area.
Yeah, there are some platforms out there that do offer off ETF 401ks. I think it's going to be a technology driven solution that then allows ETFs to really proliferate in 401k plans, in my opinion. Shelly, what about the top heaviness of the ETF space and really the fund industry in general, where we have several larger fund companies controlling bigger chunks of individual stocks? Do you have any concerns regarding corporate governance or competition or any other concerns?
I don't have any concerns about corporate governance in that sense, because you have to remember, even though you might have fund companies that have that are larger in totality, it's the fund itself that's voting the fund's shares. And so the portfolio manager or the corporate governance teams are making those decisions. So it's not necessarily done up at that top level, where all of the funds, all of their shares vote the same. We actually, ICI gets the ISS voting data for mutual funds and ETFs. And we actually have a research paper on our website that we put out in July of 2019, and we're in the process of updating it. And it does show how funds do their proxy voting. Now, you have to remember, you know, over 90% of the proxies that are put out are management proposals, and a lot of them are very pro forma, ratify the auditors. Reaffirm the current slate of directors, those types of things. And so you do see that funds and a lot of other entities vote with management. But on shareholder proposals, it's not clear. There is a lot of difference across funds in how funds vote, even funds within the same complex. Vote on shareholder proposals.
What about on the competition side? Any concerns about the top heaviness of the fund space?
Certainly, you know, the larger funds, they tend to have lower expense ratios because they have economies of scale. So that does create a little bit of an impediment for entrants to come in, but that's not unique to the fund industry. That is the case of any product you would want to look at. So new entrants, when they come in, they have to be price competitive and they have to show value. And we've seen in the ETF industry that you can have some very, very successful new entrants come in. I'm sure that you know some of these sponsors.
No, I agree. I mean, we cover them all the time. I mean, I think of somebody like ARK Invest, Innovator with a defined outcome ETFs, even some of the larger firms that came to the ETF party a little late, like a JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs, are finding a lot of success. So I kind of go back and forth on this, because certainly the scale of some of these companies, they can really drive down costs, and it does make it harder for upstart issuers to compete in some regards. And I do have some concerns at times around intellectual property, where a larger fund company can sort of use some of the smaller ETF issuers as their farm system. And if they see a good idea come out of one of them and it gains some traction, they can effectively replicate that same strategy and charge lower for it. But no, I think it's been good seeing somebody like ARK Invest have a lot of success, because it shows it can be done.
Yeah, it definitely can be done. And I think that, you know, given that the SEC has approved, has exemptive orders out there now for some of the semi-transparent active ETFs, that's a way for other fund sponsors that are more in the active space, but we're concerned about sort of having the full portfolio transparency to allow, you know, other proprietary traders to kind of suss out what their investment strategy was, allows them to come in and also just try to see if they can get their market out there. You know, it's you can put your product out there and see if there's going to be demand for it.
Shelly, just a couple minutes left. Two other quick topics here. As ETFs continue proliferating, we are seeing increasingly complex products come to market. I'm curious, does that concern you at all? And maybe along with that, talk about how you think the industry can do a better job of educating, particularly retail investors.
Yeah, education is critical in ETFs. As we see more and more retail investors come into ETFs, it is extremely important for sponsors, for financial advisors, for brokerage firms to have enough accessible information out there for these retail investors to understand, you know, what it means to invest in an ETF, what it means to sort of, if you're going to move away from the mutual fund product where you have outsourced all of the trading to the portfolio manager and you're going to take that responsibility on, you have to understand what it means to actually trade in the stock market. You need to understand when is it a good time to trade. You have to understand what order type you're putting in to trade. A lot of things that are not sort of your everyday sort of knowledge.
All right. And then lastly, before I let you go, as someone representing an organization who supports regulated funds, I have to ask you about direct indexing, which I'm sure you know is getting a lot more attention now. Do you have any strong views on direct indexing? And I thought it'd be interesting hearing your take, because if you think about this, direct indexing would take investors out of regulated funds, right?
You know, yes. I mean, you know, mutual funds, ETFs, they are registered under the Investment Company Act of 1940. There's a lot of customer protections around that, particularly custody of assets, all of, you know, a lot of sort of good customer protections. I think what's interesting about the whole direct investing issue here is that people think of it as, or I've gotten questions, well, do you think this is going to take away from mutual funds and ETFs? And right now, honestly, I don't think so. You know, if you want an index fund, be it a mutual fund or an ETF, what happens in the index fund? The portfolio managers automatically rebalance that for you to match the index. You don't have to worry about doing that or doing that in terms of direct indexing. And plus, you can get these index products at very, very cheap prices. Tough to replicate that, I think, potentially when you're doing direct indexing on your own.
No, I agree. I've said before, I think there are certain use cases for direct indexing, in particular, if you're a higher net worth investor with a taxable account, or if you're you have very specific criteria around ESG, those sorts of things. I think we'll see direct indexing have some success. But to your point, I think it's difficult to compete with the regulated wrappers we have that are at a very low cost, very tax efficient today. So again, I keep saying I'll be interested to see how this evolves, but I think direct indexing will have a place. It'll just be another tool in the toolbox. But Shelley, really appreciate the insight this week. We'll certainly have to do this again. Thank you for joining me.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Shelley Ananavich, Senior Director of Industry and Financial Analysis at the Investment Company Institute.